Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome and thank you very much for joining us today. I recently spoke with David Novak about his super fascinating new book, Japanoise, Music at the Edge of Circulation. This came out in 2013 with Duke University Press. Now, when you think of noise, what is noise? Is it a musical form? Is it a musical genre? In thinking about this question, but also thinking beyond this question, David Novak takes us into the various scenes, spaces, and phenomena from which noise, and Japanoise in particular, has emerged as an object. The book is based on extended fieldwork in North America and in Japan over the space of 10 years and beyond. And it thinks about noise as a form of sound and a form of music that can only exist, as Novak puts it, in circulation. So what this winds up being is a really fascinating ethnography that introduces these kinds of mediated human and technological individuals that include human beings. They include spaces, including a space called drugstore. They include objects like a repurposed Speak and Spell. They include an electronic hot pot. But it also asks us to think more critically and more creatively about some of the kinds of phenomena that a lot of these actors collectively engage in and that are really central to our work as thinkers, as scholars, as readers. And these are phenomena like circulation. So what does it mean to talk about circulation of anything historically and ethnographically? And can we problematize circulation and the kind of work that it does by looking at a particular case study of a really fascinating group of musicians, sound artists, technologists, people, and the kind of work that they've been doing and have been doing at the intersection of music and not, performance and not, noise and not. It's a really fascinating study. It's a really, really engagingly written book. And I hope you have a chance to read it because I imagine you'll learn a lot from it as I did as well. I really enjoyed talking with David about it, and I hope you enjoyed the conversation. And certainly, I hope that it inspires you to go out and learn more about some of these people that we talk about and that he writes about, because some of them are super, super fascinating and really interesting, whether or not you think of yourself as somebody who's fundamentally interested in noise music. So it was a pleasure, and I hope you enjoy. We're here today with David Novak to talk about his new book, Japanoise, Music at the Edge of Circulation. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, David, and thanks very much for making the time to talk with me, and especially at the end of a long week on a Friday early evening. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Carla. Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
So, David, could you say a little bit about yourself and your background, and specifically, what brought you to the study of modern Japan and to musical cultures within that context specifically?
Sure. Well, it's kind of a long story. I could go back quite a long way, and I do in the beginning of the book talk about this. But I went to Japan with stars in my eyes. You know, I was 19 when I went to Japan, and I was very unprepared end up doing something like noise. I went originally interested in medieval Japan, and I had taken a class on medieval Japan, and it was, I think, the 1989. And I had read a book called Jobs in Japan, you know, which enabled me to believe that it was going to be fine for me to drop out of school and just move to Japan and teach English and manage for myself. I didn't do any kind of program or anything like that. I just dropped out of school, and with my girlfriend at the time, we moved we ended up in Kyoto because I was, like I said, obsessed with this medieval Japanese stuff. That's all I really knew. And I was a musician. I was interested in rock and underground music and a lot of other kinds of things, but my idea of Japan was, you know, that I would go and play Koto, and that I would learn, you know, language, and I would learn history, and I did those things, but I also encounter to Japan that was nothing like my expectations. And also, you know, work, life, outside of, ideas, a lot of things that, that brought me to just made me grow up. So, you know, Japan to me is connected to my growing up and my, being a person. I didn't go back for a really long time. So it wasn't, that wasn't the moment in which I formulated the project. And in fact, as I talk about in the book a little bit, what was interesting was that I didn't ever hear about anything about noise when I was in Japan. And it wasn't until I came back, a year later with, you know, with, barely enough money to start school again to, that I began to hear people tell me, you know, there's this music, that's been hitting our shores, you know, and have you ever heard about it? And I said, no, I don't know what you're talking about. And so that, you know, that became part of the fascination was that I had been there. I had had this particular kind of focus. Of course, you know, my disillusionment with my illusory expectations was part of refocusing me on other things like popular culture things, underground culture things, finding people who could connect with me about, you know, experimental music and art and just changing a lot of what, you know, getting more real really about what I was doing there.
So how did you come to focus from that sort of constellation of different sort of issues and experiences on Japanese in particular as an academic project? How did you decide to do that? And what did that involve for you in the context of graduate work?
I went back to grad school. I was in rock bands for a bunch of years. I never thought I'd go back to Japan. It was like I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I went to Indonesia and I was studying gamelan music. And when I went to school to study ethnomusicology, when I went back to school after, you know, a bunch of years of being in rock bands and traveling around the United States and things like that, living in different places, I didn't have the idea that I was going to go back and do a project on popular music or on noise or anything like that. And I actually found that gamelan wasn't a satisfactory subject for me, for reasons that had to do with the way that it had been studied and sort of my approach to Indonesia, which was also, you know, about the politics that I'd experienced there and the sort of, I was there during Suharto's New Order, and it was a very eye-opening experience. And, you know, so all those things kind of haunted my study of gamelan. So when I went back to school, I lasted about 3 or 4 weeks before I realized I wasn't really going to make it. There were people there who were really gamelan people and they really knew it and they had studied it. And I had spent most of my time doing other things in Indonesia other than gamelan for a lot of reasons. But I decided about halfway through that, you know, maybe even ethnomusicology wasn't asking the questions I wanted to ask, because that's the field I went back to school in, not East Asian studies, which was my undergrad degree. And I said, well, okay, I got to get out of this, you know, or something. That was my thought. I was playing a lot of experimental music. I had a few good friends. I was playing with Anthony Braxton, who was at Wesleyan. I was playing free jazz and I was doing electronic music with my friends. And I was doing a lot of things that followed my creative interest. And they said they knew about noise music. And they said, you know, well, since you got to have this cultural element to do your ethnomusicology dissertation, why don't you do Japan noise? Like, that'll mess them up, you know? and I thought, okay, I'll do a master's thesis on noise music. This is 1998 when I decided to do it, 1999 when I finished the master's thesis. So I wrote this master's thesis, you know, like a couple hundred pages. I went back to Japan for it. And, you know, and then I said, okay, now I'm going to quit, you know, and I didn't think, you know, that I would continue doing it. And then I found that it spun into its own life. And it actually, that's what kept me going in ethnomusicology. It wasn't the feeling of, I must be a professor in ethnomusicology, or I must continue with this, because I thought I would just, write it and stop. But I ended up finding this wonderful grad program at Columbia University, where I could do it and where people helped me think about why it was actually worth doing and important. And not to say that Wesleyan didn't do that for me as well, but it was a moment of transition. So then I decided to do the project on noise, and you know, it just sort of built on itself, as it should.
So this is the book that we're talking about, and I should mention right at the outset, it is a fabulous book. I loved this book, and it's one of the many reasons, or among the many reasons that I love this book, are the fact that it's about Japan and it's about Japanese, but it's also about so many other really wonderfully important and transformative conceptual issues that speak and are translatable well beyond the context of music studies, of Japanese studies. And I hope it gets a really wide readership because of that. And I personally learned a ton from it. So we'll get there. We'll get to all of those concepts. But before we get there, this did begin as a dissertation. And now we're talking about the book. Can you talk about any transformations along the way between those two major kind of monuments or monumental stages in the life of an academic book? Did the way you were thinking about the project transform? Were any parts of the original project dramatically transformed? And are there any important moments or aspects of that transition that you'd like to share?
Well, I had wonderful, I mean, I could start at the end, which is that it's finally out. And, you know, it feels like a very long time, and it is a very long time. The end part at Duke, was great to see it really take shape. It was also long, and I took, the comments from my wonderful reviewers very seriously, and I took a long time with it. So, from there, I'll say it started a long time ago, like with this master's thesis in 99. And what's interesting to me about the amount of time that it took to go from there to now is how consistent the things that I'm talking about have been, even in times of incredible transformation. But I'm getting onto the subject of how the world has changed and not how my writing has changed.
Well, that's okay.
Yeah. So, well, one of the things is that in the course of writing this, you know, the digital revolution reframed popular culture, and a lot of the things that were pretty normal to the circulation I was talking about, like cassette exchange, you know, went away and came back again. You know, so things like vinyl that were, you know, more normal or more part of the underground, and then they just disappeared, and then now it's back as a medium. So those kinds of things, and then that there are these consistencies with noise sort of going in and out. I call it submergent in the book, like it's sort of a submergent form in the sense that it's always surfacing and submerging again. It spends most of its time under the surface, and so it never really, you know, so if you work on another kind of popular music form and you start writing about it, you know, 15 years before you publish something significant about it, you know, you'll be hopelessly, you know, far from where you started. And I don't feel that way. I feel like I'm right in the middle. What I wrote was still right in the middle, kind of, even though people have, you know, it depends on where you're standing. So someone who's been following it for 20 years will say, yeah, that happened 20 years ago. And someone who picked it up last year will say, oh, this relates to what's happening right now. And I find that to be the most, you know, fascinating. That's what I learned the most from being with this book for so long, that you know, just following it through that time.
Now, you mentioned in the book that noise, and I should mention for listeners, when I ask you about noise, I'm using noise as in the form of the capital N noise. And why I'm doing that will become clearer, I think, to listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book over the course of our conversation. But you talk about noise as only existing in circulation. And so the nature of the kinds of transformations that you're talking about, still maintaining the kind of coherence of the subject and the phenomena that you wrote about, makes a lot of sense, right? Given the nature of what you are writing about, which is something that exists in transformation and in circulation, as you describe it in the book. So before we get to that really fascinating aspect of what you're arguing about circulation, let's make sure that we're starting at the beginning for listeners who may not have ever heard about this concept. So first things first, Japanese. What is it? For listeners,
I have no idea. I mean, the thing about the book and the idea of it is that starting at the beginning with Japan arts is starting with circulation. So it's not, you know, so the where we want to start when we have a book that's supposed to be about a music genre is with the name of it, you know, like Japan Noise, : what is it? Or if I look it up in a history of rock genres, what will it say? Who's playing it? And you know, where did it start? And what does it sound like? And those are the kinds of questions that we would ask at the beginning. And the interesting thing for me about this was that way of thinking about music didn't work for it. So although there is something that we, you know, that has been conceptualized as a genre, that's really only a small part of it. So something like Japan Noise is a phrase that got applied to this circulation, and there's a music, but then let me say there is a music, right? That so, you know, after I've given you that contrary treatment of your question, you know, let me go back to say, okay, all right, I'll do it. You know, Japan Noise is a genre that's made with this, with these electronic, guitar pedals and circuit boards and mixing boards. And it's very harsh. So it's a kind of music that isn't even conceived by its practitioners as music. And it's, you know, in that way, to put a generic name on it and call it noise is a very contrary thing to do. So people are pretty ambivalent about that. It's related to industrial music and punk music and free jazz and other genres. And you have the most famous practitioners in Japan and the United States and Europe, but especially Japan. And I found that to be the most interesting aspect of noise, because you know, you can talk about noise and noise music and noise rock, and you might have groups like Sonic Youth in under noise rock, or you might have Lou Reed, who just, you know, RIP passed with his wonderful Metal Machine Music record in 75. You know, or you could go back to Luigi Russolo in the futurist movement and say, well, these are all noise, and do a sort of trans-historical take on it. But what I wanted to focus on in the book was the way that it got sort of crystallized within a cultural frame, so that there were these people who thought of it as something Japanese. And, you know, here you have this thing that you know, has developed over, you know, many decades that, you know, that doesn't even seem to be a form, that, you know, doesn't have a consistent sound, that doesn't have you know, identifiable people necessarily who are the, you know, heroes of the genre or the center of it, and yet you have this name. And so that was an interesting starting point to think about, well, how did this happen? You know, and rather than going back to say something like grunge, where you'd say, oh, well, grunge is something that was a name that some journalist made up. But there was a bunch of musicians that were doing this. You know, you could say Nirvana and the Melvins and, you know, Mudhoney and Soundgarden and blah, blah, blah. And you can tell that history of the genre in that way. And you can pretty fairly say it comes from the Pacific Northwest from this time period and all that. And I found Japan was totally violated all of that.
And that's one of the fascinating things about the book. And so what we're going to see in the book is that all of these concepts that I've kind of trickily asked you about and that you've rightly, you know, turned on their heads are all going to be in constant motion throughout the book. And they sort of, there's a constant cycle of destruction and construction moving us through all of these kinds of phenomena. So we'll get to that as we get through the chapters. Now, as you start out the book, in the introduction, you lay out some of the basic background that undergirds the study. The book is based on extended fieldwork in North America and Japan over a 10-year period at least, from 1998 to 2008, and some materials and experiences thereafter. You have interviews here with musicians, listeners, club owners, label owners in Osaka, Kyoto, and Tokyo, fieldwork in New York City, San Francisco, Providence, London, Ontario, which is one of my favorite moments of the book. we'll definitely get to them. Observation of performances, participation in some performances, which is fascinating, and all these other kinds of experience and work in various sorts of material, written and conceptual and experienced archives that all together undergird this really interesting study. Now, I brought up already one of the key terms that you bring up in this introduction of the book, and that is circulation. As you put it, noise can only exist in circulation. But rather than taking this notion of circulation for granted, one of the really helpful things and one of the really transformative things I think that the book is doing is problematizing this idea of circulation we tend to take for granted. You mention here wanting to challenge the comparative models of exchange that take circulation to be something that happens between cultures. Instead, for the book, circulation creates culture, it constitutes culture. So to get us started in this deep cut through the book, can you talk a little bit about that? Circulation, its importance for what you're doing in this early part of the book and how you're trying to reframe it.
Okay. So circulation is one of those, again, one of the, that's something that has changed over the course of writing this, that it, that concept has gone from something that was less discussed to being something that's actually quite central to, I think, anthropology meetings a couple of years ago was called Cultures of Circulation. And there were a few important articles. One of them was by Benjamin Lee and Edward Lipuma in Public Culture. And they had an issue in the Millennial Quartet all about circulation. And that sort of changed my thinking a lot about what I was looking at. And I kept on trying to think why. I knew that I was, you know, like I said at the beginning, trying to mess up, you know, some of the connections between genre or musical cultures and, you know, sort of a centralized place and identity. But I didn't really know how to do it. And but I knew that this music was about, you know, feedback. And so that was the concept that I was going to go to. But first, you know, circulation was the idea that I took up. And circulation, you know, coming from a Potteri and others that influenced me, really conceptualized globalization as in terms of these different flows and scapes, and the way that music fit into that was, you know, to me fairly obvious. But the way that it had been studied a lot in ethnomusicology was you looked at a culture, and then when you saw music that traveled, like let's say South African music through Paul Simon, or in other ways in which the mediascape was formed by the movement of a form from one place to another, what you were looking at a lot of time was the transformations of the material and the way that it often violated the sort of cultural norms of the original place. And, you know, thinking about Japan noise, it was kind of an obvious place to start. There's an Orientalism to it. There's a way in which you might look at it as something that's a Japanese form that, you know, was the noise was introduced in the distortion of the channel or something that something that started in one place ends up, you know, being wrongly reframed somewhere else. And I found that was definitely true, but that form, the distorted form, the noisy form, the translation fed back to the original. And so that, circulation became essential for me to understand how this thing came about. And it wasn't just, you know, following a flow, but looking at it as a cultural process, that circulation was something that made this happen. There was no way to conceive of it outside of that. And that makes it very, very frustrating. I mean, I know that you're doing a stalwart job, you know, trying to get me to say what the book's about. And I think it's always really hard for me and when I'm talking about it and I'm sure it is also for you to hear it, that I can't just settle down and say like, here's what this book's about, or here's what the genre is, but I'm only understanding, what I wrote about through that, circulatory frame. And so I wanted to find a way to address that and move it from the way that circulation had been discussed as something that, moved, you know, music from one place to another, or culture from one place to another, to something that could be seen as a recursive process or a culture making process that breaks down, and which distortions weren't simply called out for being sort of byproducts of an Orientalist or colonial system, but that they were things that that ended up forming the forces of cultural knowledge. So you have, you know, the cultural politics of globalization is something that you can only conceive of in terms of its ongoing interaction. And so I was very influenced by Anna Tsing's work, her book, especially called Friction. And I really thought of noise as a form of friction in which global interconnections, you know, can really only be understood if you look at the ways in which they break down, or people who aren't included in circulation still participating, or misinterpretations and misunderstandings still being part of the frame, still being part of the picture. It's not just that someone, you know, far away, you know, ends up liking something or hearing something or buying something from somewhere else. It's all the things that connect to that. So it's a network based thought, but it's also something that depends on sort of uncertainty and randomness, if you want to look at it that way. And so that then you look at something that folds in on itself as it goes.
Great, thank you. And I think actually it's totally appropriate to the nature of the subject matter to be talking about circulation and genre and noise as things that are both things and not things, right? That constantly in motion. And that's one of the, I think, great insights that comes out of the book. And so it's not frustrating at all. I'm actually just fascinated in hearing how you're describing your own sort of moments of and concepts of inspiration as we talk about these. So you talk about another really central concept that motivates the work that the entirety of the book does here in the introduction. This is related to circulation, but it takes a different form. You call feedback circulation at the edge. And this brings us to this other really massively important concept of feedback. Japanese, as you argue early in the book, could only have been produced through feedback between Japan and North America. You talk about feedback between recording and performance later on in the book. There's also the sonic phenomenon of feedback. Feedback structures everything here and infuses everything. So can you talk a little bit about the centrality of the concept of and the motivating power of feedback as it shapes the argument that you're creating here in the book?
Sure. It takes me, like you said, it takes, you know, me everywhere in the book. So I'll try and not let, you know, let myself get swept up in a particular version of it. But thinking about feedback, you know, let me start with just what feedback, how you might conceive of feedback as, you know, in the world. So, you know, we know feedback as sonically as a mistake. It's something that, you know, when someone holds a microphone too close to a speaker and you have this sound, and that sound usually means something's gone wrong or somebody's doing something wrong. Or it's somebody who's deliberately confronting their system. So in music, you have feedback usually at the, you know, when Jimi Hendrix smashes his guitar or when somebody, you know, holds the guitar up to the amp, and these kinds of things happen. So there's this question of intentionality and causality when you have something like feedback. And throwing that into the mix with circulation, I thought was really useful because it helped understand how something could be a part of an improvisational process, or, you know, like, what is the expression that comes out of that? Is that a person expressing themselves? Is that the machine breaking down, or is that, you know, a mistake, or is it on purpose? And there's all those questions that go into global circulation between cultures that don't necessarily always have everything in common, or when they do have, but they still have incredible connections. So that when I say it could only happen between the United States and Japan, it's because the United States and Japan are already so deeply connected. And yet there are so many disconnections and ruptures in that circulation, so that, you know, people in Japan know everything about, you know, American popular media and culture, and they can emulate it closely, and they you know, they're often accused of just imitating it too closely. And on the other side, you have a culture that couldn't name, you know, two or three Japanese musicians of any kind, and that knows almost nothing about what's going on. So you have these, and they're comparable, you know, late capitalist media networks, but their connections are really not that great. So I talk about anime as an example, and, you know, Ian Condrey's work is interesting in this, and his new book, I want to give a shout out to that. And, you know, Chris Yano's book on Hello Kitty. And, you know, there are a bunch of people who are pointing out how these things like anime and Hello Kitty, you know, come out of these connections. And they, you know, no one would say that these things represent like the core of a Japanese culture or something like that. At the same time, they do to the world, and they have greater and greater relevance to the Japanese government, to anyone who is involved in cultural exchange between Japan and the United States has to deal with these things. So I thought, you know, although noise doesn't come close to the scale of those things, it represents this kind of a connection. So that's one aspect of feedback. Then, you know, in terms of the sound and the technological subjectivity, I thought that that question of intentionality was really interesting when you looked at musical forms, because you thought, well, you know, when someone goes to see a noise performance, you know, why am I enduring this? Or are they doing this on purpose? You know, who wants to listen to this? How did this happen? How is this a mistake? I mean, is it a mistake to call this music at all? And those are legitimate questions. They're not just, you know, sort of, sometimes I get people who are ashamed to say these things to me after a talk or something. They'll say like, you know, I have to admit that I can't, you know, stand the music you played, or I have to admit that I was with you until you played the example. And, you know, it's sort of like, well, of course, this music is not made, you know, for people to instantly connect to. And so that question of like, are you serious? Is a really important question, or, you know, is this on purpose? And so feedback asks us to think about that, you know, whether somebody's doing, you know, how much does it have to do with expression and music? And so it sort of challenges those Enlightenment ideas about, you know, musical creativity and genius and authorship and the authenticity of sound and its production. So I get into that in this chapter that's all about, you know, the way it's made. And so I make that connection to the way it's made. Those are a few of the things about feedback. I won't, you know, continue to list them unless you think I've forgotten something.
No, that's great. And we'll get into feedback a little bit more later in the conversation too. It's perfect. So as we move into the next chapter, scenes of liveness and deadness, you talk about all three of those components and their centrality in conceptualizing and experiencing at least one part of this phenomenon of noise. So scenes, because you bring us into the spaces of noise. So the live house, the fact that it's performed often in very small, very crowded spaces, liveness and deadness. And we'll talk about those too and what those mean for you in a moment. But you open and you close this chapter by introducing us to a performance by performers of noise that really encapsulates all of these phenomena as they emerge in this chapter. And this is a group called the Incapacitants. So can you take us into what's going on in this chapter in the Incapacitants performance at the No Fun Fest? And how does this get us to understanding here, if you could, what you mean by liveness and deadness and the work that that's doing here in the chapter?
Okay. So first, Incapacitants is probably one of the most famous noise groups in the world. They're sort of unarguably noise. And like I said, that because the genre is hard to define, you know, you have a lot of argument going on. So when you have somebody that's in sort of unarguably considered like a masters of something, then that's an exception. But there are these really interesting it's a really interesting case because they, although they're really well known in the United States and elsewhere in outside of Japan, they have only been known through the circulation of their recordings. So really the chapter is about trying to look at feedback and circulation, you know, through the ways in which, you know, music is conceptualized, music performance is conceptualized. Most of the time when we think, like I mentioned grunge before, and when you think about grunge, you think about Kurt Cobain, you know, stage diving or something like that. There's this performative aspect that really encapsulates it. And when you want, if you, you know, want to say, I was really there, or I really understand it, you were there in 1990 or 87 or something in Seattle, you know, watching these bands play. And so with popular music scenes, you have this idea of a scene, and the people who are there at these clubs in Seattle are going to be the people who, you know, determine what that scene, you know, what it's like, and then it grows from there. So there's an authenticity to place, and there's an authenticity to performance. And you know, I thought, well, in a situation that violates those, or when it doesn't provide them, at least, how do people conceive? How do they make authenticity out of it? And so I was inspired by Louise Menke's book, Sound of Africa, which talks about Zulu musicians and the way in which their music is produced to represent a cultural place, and then how it circulates to people who are disconnected from that place. And I thought it's interesting how that happens in the U.S. So I was lucky enough to experience in the event that at the end of this chapter I describe, which is the performance of Incapacitance when they finally did come, you know, to the U.S. and play in 2007 at this No Fun Fest, and all of the noise people on the East Coast came to this thing, and they overwhelmed the performers with their energy. And it was this very intense moment in which these people sort of enacted all of the years of you know, relating to this music and not having a sense of, just sort of embodied the circulation in that moment. And it would be really easy to look at that and say, and this is the point of the chapter, well, that's the definitive point. You know, the point in which something becomes real or is realized or, you know, takes place, is performed, and then, you know, that's it. But in fact, it's all the other disconnected experiences, you know, that you know, are just as crucial. And so I was interested in the sort of relationship between recordings and live music and how they reinforce one another. And in our studies of music culture, anthropological, ethnomusicological studies, we often, you know, look at these things as being separate, you know, that you have, first you have the real thing, the performance, and then you have this thing, like I was saying before, that goes out and emanates from it and is circulated. And that's where all the telephone game stuff happens, and the distortion is introduced, and all the unreality and orientalisms and misinterpretations and illusions are inserted into the circulation. And I thought, well, that's not how this happened. And so I wanted to, you know, sort of go back and look at that again.
Great. Thank you so much. And this chapter also raises, and I won't ask you to talk too much about it because I'm going to ask you to talk about other things that are in later chapters. But this chapter also introduces the kind of sensory experience of listening to noise, and the importance of volume and intensity to that experience. And I mention that because one of the words that you used in just describing that chapter and the phenomena therein was this word embodied. And this is actually really important to the work that happens really in the entire book, but also the work that brings us into the next chapter. This is thinking about embodiment. Here and elsewhere in the book, what emerges for the reader, or one of the many things that emerges for the reader, is the importance of physicality, of in-person physical contact with other people, with spaces, with recordings, with materials. And that infuses everything about the book, at least from the perspective of this reader, right, of one reader. Now, this takes us into issues in the second chapter of, okay, keeping this importance of physicality and embodiment in mind, and having just understood from the previous chapter the importance of recording as formative and shaping noise, where do listeners and where did listeners in the 1990s find out about recordings? Where did they go to learn about noise and learn about the music and get access to some of the recordings? This chapter looks into that question by exploring the importance of record stores to the spaces of noise in Japan. And you talk about this in terms of mapping. So could you say a little bit here about that, about these central notions of, first, how did listeners in the 1990s find out about noise producers and music? And how is your idea of mapping central to the kind of argument that you're making about that curation of noise by record stores and label owners here in the chapter?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks. Yeah. The mapping and, you know, is related to place and how, you know a place. And so the question, you know, when you start with something called Japan noise is, you know, well, what's the Japan part have to do with it? And how do people, you know about it? So I thought a map was a useful metaphor, in the sense that it's an outsider's point of view, and it's sort of, how you navigate a space that you know, you wouldn't map your house, right? You could find your way through it blindfolded and you know it because it's part of your life. And a map isn't necessary. It's only necessary when you're explaining to someone what something is. And, you know, there's a real, conflict there with how you bring that knowledge, that's implicit knowledge of place, out into the world. And there are many different ways to do it. And so I was really inspired by a work by Steve Feld and Keith Basso, anthropologists who work on place, and especially Basso's work with the Apache, who I talk about here, Western Apache, and how knowledge of something that's very deep to a group of people can be circulated or put into language or put into circulation among others. So at the same time as I'm saying it's a metaphor and all these things, there were maps that were published. So if you needed to find a record store in Tokyo, you needed a map to get there, because you just couldn't, even Japanese people need maps to find these places. You can't just stumble into them. They're on the top of these buildings, office buildings on the seventh floor in the back room, and you don't know where they are. And so there's that aspect of the underground in which it's a place that's waiting to be found. And to map it is a very ambivalent and complicated thing to do. The same thing is true about letting people know about an underground music. It's like giving someone a map to buried treasure, and the people who buried it don't necessarily want it to be dug up. I know that my book, you know, caused some conflict in that way too. It's kind of a map of, and telling you, oh, well, there's a history here. Or, oh, there's this person and that person. Incapacitance is important. That kind of thing. And the ramifications of that are very complicated for representing social life, representing music and people. And at the same time, you know, you have people who really, they use the maps to make their own reality. And so they bring the knowledge that they get from these records back. So I talk about compilations, and that's a very common thing in defining scenes, that you get a record that's called like the sound of Seattle or something. And it would be, you know, 10 tracks from bands that were hot at that moment or something. And then if you had that, you would trust, this map is guiding me somewhere real. And even though I've never been to Seattle and I don't know, you know, if I listen to these tracks, I will get a sense of what that musical culture is all about. And you put your trust in that, or you give authenticity to it. And, you know, how does it take that role? How does just because somebody put these songs together, and who's behind it, and what's the communication here, and what are the consequences of having a compilation called Land of the Rising Noise or something like that, or Welcome to Dreamland, these compilations that I talk about, and all the different intentions. None of these people are deliberately trying to misrepresent anything. You know, it's just the act of map making requires a representational practice that brings up things they would never have considered.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And sort of while we're on the topic of maps and space and these sorts of issues, the chapters really move very beautifully from, almost in a kind of, I want to say, musical way. There's a flow to the topics from chapter to chapter. They feel very organically connected. And this is a perfect example of that. We just talked about record stores and maps as spaces of the production of noise culture and the production of this as an idea, and also spaces of access. Another kind of space of noise that you move us really beautifully into in the next chapter are spaces of listening. So we move here from the production and recording spaces in chapter one to the spaces of access and curation in chapter two, and here to the spaces of listening, which are also spaces of production. Chapter three really interestingly compares practices of listening in two different kinds of spaces. The post-war jazzukisa, which was a kind of controlled, genre-focused listening to jazz records. You would go in, you would be quiet. It was a very different kind of space from this other kind of space that you introduce us to and that you compare that with. And that was the kind of free space that became one of the central spaces of the emergence of noise. And you mentioned drugstore in particular. So can you tell us a little bit about this kind of space of noise making, noise production, and noise listening in this context of the book? What was drugstore, and how does understanding this in contrast to what was going on in this jazzukisa kind of environment help us understand your argument for in this part of the book?
Okay. So drugstore was a small space for a particular group of students and young people in the late 70s and early 80s to listen to records. And what they were listening to were records that weren't easy to get. You know, a lot of underground prog rock and electronic music and free jazz and just all these things that didn't fit and that were very hard to get in Japan. So I compared that with Jazukisa, which are these places that have been around for quite a while. And Taylor Atkins has a wonderful book about this called Blue Nippon, which he doesn't talk about only Jazukisa, but about jazz in Japan. And these special places for listening where you could go and hear music that you wouldn't be able to access otherwise. And that had a lot to do with the way that jazz and other foreign musics were socialized in Japan. And so at the same time, you know, there's this sort of way in which jazukisa were about studying a genre or studying a culture. And these people were listening to stuff that they were trying to detach in a way from its source and say, you know, well, I don't really care that this comes from Germany or England or the United States. Like, it's all noise to me. And the fact that they put these things together in a new category that they called noise was a way for them to sort of find their own space through listening, a creative space that led them to start doing their own thing. So they started improvising and making labels to put out their own stuff. And so that this moment of a historical moment is the only moment where I get, you know, really specifically historical in the book. And I deal with these particular people who hung out at a drugstore, and I know all these people and, you know, heard the story from them. I knew it was important because I heard it from so many people, that this special place. And I thought that was a really interesting way to look at their story, that they hung out together for these years and listened to all this stuff and called it noise.
And there's a great discussion in this part of the book too, that I'll just mention for listeners to let them know that it's there and it's wonderful, of the founding members of a group that becomes really important in this book called Hijokaidan. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah. Hijokaidan.
Hijokaidan,
yeah.
Forming at drugstore and transforming into this group or cult collective that did these really extreme performances. And you describe the drugstore environment as this kind of crucible from which this group, this mode of performance, and ultimately a record label emerged in a really interesting way. But they're not the only group that's really fascinating in this part of the book. In fact, the next chapter, Genre Noise, looks at two groups and or performers who really encapsulate in very, very different kinds of ways moments of and examples of noise as you are treating it in the book. One of them, as you know, as somebody working at a Canadian university, I have to open with these as the first example. One of them is this Canadian group, Nihilist Spasm Band. They began performing in 1965 in London, Ontario, as the official band, and as you mentioned here, most of the members of the Nihilist Party of Canada. So, okay, you need to indulge me here. Can you say a little bit about this Nihilist Spasm Band and how do they come into the story of Japanoise, and like, what's their entry into the story in Japan in particular, which happens and which is actually kind of interesting?
Yeah. The Nihilist Spasm Band is a wonderful story. They're wonderful people. And I met them because I was going to see Hijokaidan play in London, which is their hometown in Ontario. And I knew about them, but through the Japanese noise people. So the thing about the Nihilist Spasm Band was that they were playing for many years in their, you know, town, and they didn't really care about making records or getting out there that much. They had done a few recordings and they were issued on a, you know, like 1,000 copies, and the copies went out there in the world, and you know, no one ever, you know, made much of them, and except for in Japan, they were the records that they were listening to at drugstore. And so the Hijokaidan and Jojo Hiroshige, who starts the Alchemy Records label, you know, as always wanted to connect with these people. And he finally writes them a letter in 96 and says, you know, can we put out some of your music? And then, you know, would you come to, I guess it was before that in the early 90s. And then in 96, they go to Japan. He brings them to Japan to play. And everybody there is introduced to the group as the godfathers of noise. So the idea here is that you have, again, it's like this retroactive feedback, you know, in which the history has to be fed back into something that already exists. The circulation between North America and Japan is so strong that now you need origin stories. And of course, you know, it's not wrong. I mean, these people were, you know, among the groups that were listened to in drugstore. And, you know, they are an incredibly interesting group, but they were sort of on their own up there in Canada doing their own thing. And then they suddenly were brought into circulation and they said, well, noise is, that's okay. You know, they weren't even calling themselves noise per se. And now that circulation has very strongly defined their history. They're very unique people. And I got to spend some time with them and I stayed at Art Pratton's house and they're just wonderful people. And telling the story of that connection was a way to talk about how genres are these, you know, sort of, you know, ongoing constructions and ongoing practices that involve all sorts of people that might never otherwise have been connected.
That's right. And also reading about them in the book, I should mention, I immediately wanted to meet them and have them over for coffee. And this is one example of many, many in the book where the figures that you're writing about are very sympathetically and are very wonderfully introduced and rendered. And it just, it's a really wonderful set of characters and people and sort of very humanized stories about these individuals that comes out of the book. So it's a very human story as well, which I really loved. Now, one of the other humans in this part of the book is Akita Masami, who goes by the name of Merzbo. I'm not going to ask you to talk about him actually at this point, because I want to ask you about some other chapters. And this is ironic because this artist, as you put it in the book, came to define the genre of Japanese for a new audience overseas. And I'm not going to ask you to talk about him. But
okay.
I will mention this for listeners because he's apparently become really the kind of figurehead for a lot of the way people experience and understand Japanese. And you talk about him here in the context of his work, of the extremity of his work, and of the sheer quantity of releases of his work in the context of putting him into dialogue with what's happening with Nihilist Spasm Band and using the dialogue between them to raise this issue of genre. Now, as we move, though, further into the book, there's a lot here that we could spend a whole lot of time on, and we could easily spend another 2 hours just talking about the next chapter. So I'm going to go through this fairly, I'm going to sort of dip in and dip out here, but I want to make sure that we get to at least with a little bit of what's happening in the next chapter. So the next chapter, Feedback, Subjectivity, and Performance, takes this organizing concept, this really important notion of feedback that we mentioned at the very beginning of our conversation, and explores very different ways and different contexts in which feedback structures noise and gives it its lack of structure as well, in which feedback is really central to this story. So you talk about feedback as a metaphor for cultural exchange and reciprocity in social science. You talk about feedback in terms of creativity and the performance of noise. But you also talk about feedback as part of the electrical sound and the technical structure of the performance system of noise. And this is one of the things that I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about. You've already mentioned some of the equipment used by noise practitioners, noise performance artists, but could you speak a little bit more to the technology of and the sort of machinic aspect of what's going on in noise performances, in noise recordings, and in noise production? Because this also gets at another phenomenon that happens later in the book where you talk about the importance of machines, but also machines only in their discourse with the analog. So let's take a moment here to talk about feedback, but feedback in the context of technology, the machinic, and the structure and tools of sound production for the artist of noise. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, feedback is the way that a lot of noise is made. Not all. I mean, but the basic idea of noise performance and noise recordings is to set up a circuit and then overload it and create feedback loops within it. So you have something one of the things that you want to describe is the sort of iconic relationship between an idea and like harmony and the culture that made it. So in the West, we have the idea of harmony, and that music is supposed to sort of reflect that, and that you should feel harmony when music is good. And when you hear noise, it means something's gone wrong. Those are ideas that come from our epistemologies about music. And so I was inspired to think about how people live with technology and look at the ways in which they create sound as part of an epistemology of creativity. And I thought, well, what kind of creative subject comes out of that idea of a circuit that doesn't necessarily, it's not like a person speaking, like I have an idea, I put the saxophone to my mouth, I play a sound, I put my emotion into it. It's like me speaking. And when you hear it, you understand what I'm saying. That's very different than taking a microphone and putting up to a speaker and creating a loop and having this, you know, racket come out and then trying to manipulate that racket or something like that. Or is it different? And that was one of the questions that I asked throughout the book. How is noise not just a kind of music that lots of people wouldn't recognize as such, but couldn't you just call it music? And lots of people might make that argument, and I do. So there's that question of what is musical subjectivity in this case? And you have machines, you know, sort of have always created problems. And we don't think about a violin as a machine or the act of performing a repetitive motion like practicing as a technology. But they are all technologies of musical subjectivity that or techniques of musical subjectivity that help to create the sort of machines and they help to create the expectations and the forms of communication that surround music. So the fact that you had this thing where you plugged in a circuit and you had it feed back into itself and there was all these electronics and at the end of it, it was all going to be destroyed. To me, I thought was a really interesting way to look at some of the other metaphors that come out of the music, the idea of circulation, the idea that somebody somewhere is connected to someone else, but in a maybe involuntary way, things change just as they circulate.
Great. And one of the other things that comes up in this chapter that I just want to mention, because it brings us back to the issue of embodiment and sort of physicality of a lot of this story. You talk here about what you call the profound physical intimacy that noise artists have with their electronic setups. And this is ultimately kind of a paradox here because they're vulnerable to the equipment they use, even as if they are destroying it and controlling it. So it's a really interesting again, point at which we have this intimacy and this physical intimacy in particular coming into this story.
Yeah.
Now, as we move toward the last couple of chapters of the book, chapter 6 brings us directly into not just noise, but Japan in particular, the issue of Japan, the context of Japan, the concept of Japan as it is structuring the story. You open here with the 2011 Experimental Music and Art Festival in Fukushima. Sorry, I'm now pronouncing everything wrong, but listeners get that from me.
No, that's okay. Sounds good.
Okay, good. That's Fukushima. I'm just going to pronounce it both ways just to cover all my bases. So you open with this this Experimental Music and Art Festival in 2011 and talk here about the possible conceptual link and relationship between radiation and feedback and noise in a really interesting way. Now, this leads us into here what I want to ask you to talk a little bit about as you discuss it in the chapter, and that's the idea of Japanoise as a kind of critique of technoculture and one that's specifically embedded in the sensibilities of Japan in the 80s and 90s. So could you talk a little bit about that? Because that brings us right into the context of Japan and of technoculture therein, just very specifically.
Right. So it's that question of, well, what is the context of Japan and what is Japan as a figure in this relationship? And so when you have the idea that of technology also, you know, brings us to question, you know, what is our choice and to what extent Japan developed the way that it did out of choice. And the fact that Japan was developed in the post-war as the technological factory for the world or the electronics factory for the world, and how much of that is an outgrowth of as was explained in a lot of orientalist accounts of the 80s as a sort of cultural attribute. And there's no denying that Japan has this special connection to technology and that it's represented through technology and that you can think of Japan and noise as part of a techno culture. Now, I don't think that Japan is, of course, I'm arguing that that it's not just Japan, and that the reason, part of the reason that there is a sort of feelingful connection between fans in North America who aren't, you know, connected to a Japanese cultural space to Japan noise is that they feel similarly about the dangers of technology, and they fear technology, and that the reasons that that the music has a connection and appeal has to do with both the expectation that Japan represents a technological space through things like anime and science fiction that are consumed in North America about Japan, in which, you know, Japan is pigeonholed as a place of robotic technologies and things like that. And then also that both places share the anxieties of living in a culture that forces people to use technologies in which people aren't sure. And when you work with music, for instance, who's not on Facebook? If you're not on Facebook, what's going to happen to you? You know, are you going to still be part of society? And those aren't like idle questions. And, right. and so the questions about like what kind of a person gets made in that relationship, and how creativity and music can sort of express people's position in relation to something like Tamagotchi or something like that. I mean, is that your pet, or is that your friend, or is that, what is going on there? And Allison's wonderful book, Millennial Monsters, deals with a lot of this stuff. So I was trying to get to how that works in these performances, which, as you say, involve, you know, destruction. And so some of these things that happen, like somebody driving a bulldozer into a club and, or smashing or burning speakers or destroying their electronics just as a matter of course, even though those electronics are their basic expressive tools. That's what they use to make their music. What's going on there? So, you know, that's what that chapter is about.
And this is, I'm really glad you brought up the bulldozers and the sort of the spectacle of this as well. Or in bringing up the bulldozers, one of the things that listeners might experience is a sense of the spectacle of this, as I should put it. One of the reasons, actually, I haven't been structuring this interview the way I could be, right? Though I could be asking you all the way through about all of these really wonderfully evocative, sort of fantastic moments in the book where there is this sense of spectacle, you know, driving the bulldozer through the building, smashing all of the materials on the table, having this, you know, crowd sort of pulsate through and almost overwhelm the performers in the middle of the room. And I think that one of the things that would happen by structuring the story like that, which I was tempted to do because it's so fascinating. And I mentioned this so that listeners also have a sense of the fascinating vignettes in this book and the scenes that were brought into in this book. But one of the reasons I didn't do that is that it seems to me in reading this that it's not about the spectacle for the sake of spectacle, right? I mean, it's about the kind of experience that these moments are creating and the larger kind of themes and arguments that you're using them to make, not just about noise, but about how we understand what we're doing when we try to understand the concept of Japan, how we understand relationships between, you know, bodies and technology and these larger themes. And so I mention this just to make clear to listeners too, there are many, many stories embedded in the book, and there are many, many ways we could have gone into them. And the bulldozers are super important and fascinating. And it's interesting to think about the different ways I think we could have entered into the story about these performances and the different kinds of experiences that would have, you know, led us to in terms of understanding the book. Anyway, this is me going off on a tangent because, as you can see, this is a very thoughtful book, and it's made me think really hard about a lot of the questions that you're bringing up here.
Thank you.
So I digress. So I don't want to let you go and close up before I ask you about the cassettes. So if you'll indulge me,
sure.
I want to just ask you just a question or two about this last body chapter of the book before we close up. So chapter 7 looks at what you call the future of cassette culture. It looks at the importance of the cassette and cassette culture to the circulation of noise, but also to keeping it underground. So at the same time, both of these aspects of the ways that cassette culture shapes noise are equally important and create a kind of feedback loop among each other. So you talk about here the phenomenon whereby in the 1980s, you had to really want to find it in order to find noise. And if you found it, you found it on a cassette. Whereas today, cassettes actually are used to impose limits on the accessibility to noise, given the omnipresence of musical circulation of sort of music as a commodity in the context of new media. So this is what I'd like to ask you to talk about. You make an argument here that noise's inaccessibility was crucial to its circulation between North America and Japan, and that part of this has to do with its embracing of an embodiment within a cassette culture. So can you talk about that importance of a cassette culture?
Yes, absolutely. Well, this chapter is really here as a way of, it's a way of saying, I'm not going to talk about the internet.
Right.
Or it's a way of saying, I am going to talk about the internet without, you know, writing a whole chapter about what's happening now online with noise, which is the way that you could take this. And I thought, you know, well, I did an ethnographic project here. I'm not going to go and explain what's happening online, although I do, you know, some ethnographic work online. And of course, it did change. But what I found was interesting about noise was how dedicated it was to analog forms of circulation and equipment, but also the fact that cassettes were this natural continuity, even through a period in which no commercial context was available. And of course, that was very appealing. Now you have actually more and more cassettes. You have actually start to see them in little record stores, those that are left. But that cassettes offered, I thought, a lot of the things that people associate with MP3 and with digital technologies. So you have a form that is cheap and democratic and accessible, and that you can send, you know, quickly. And that, you know, why didn't it revolutionize the music industry was everybody's question about the cassette. And I'm going to make the argument, yeah, it did, you know, and that you had that you wouldn't have something like noise without, not without the cassette. The cassette didn't make it happen, but that because they grew together. And the idea that you wouldn't know where it came from is somewhat like the way that things can circulate online, that something can become like a meme, and it's a meme because of its sort of incommensurability, or it's hard, difficult to interpret it. And what is this? What is this? Like sigh is an example. You know, do people know about this? Are they going to say, oh, it's Korean? He's dancing this dance, and Gangnam Style is what I'm talking about. You know, something like that. And I said, well, this is not that dissimilar. I mean, you can look at the way that an underground culture formed around these cassette circulations, and see that a lot of the same expectations were being set up by the circulation, the idea of a participatory democratic media. And then you have the heart of the chapter, which is discussing how people did it, that there was of course Fluxus and male art before that. And there were other contexts of this, but that there were these people who just lived in these vastly different places and could imagine themselves as part of a global music scene. Because you could sit in wherever, in Canada or in Louisiana or in some part of Japan that wasn't close to a city, and put a tape in the mail and get one back from some other part of the world with no information, just the here's some sounds for you. And that to me is a very fascinating thing to think about and look at. And it resembles a lot of the ways things that have become more normal in online circulations.
Well, thank you so much for making the time to talk with me about this. There's a ton of material that we didn't have a chance to talk about. And I'll mention before I give you a chance to have the floor a little bit, that there is also an epilogue. And this epilogue to the book looks at the ways that the landscape of noise has changed since you wrote the book, and also takes us into some of the ways that some of the main figures that you mentioned in the book have changed. One is now a fortune teller.
Yeah.
Right? I loved that. And it talks about the fact that noise is also it's not a stable historical object, right? It's an object insofar as it's an object that is change, that is always changing, and that hasn't ended. And so looking in the epilogue at ways that continues to unfold is actually really interesting. So given that, there's a ton that we didn't have a chance to talk about, and we could talk easily for another few hours about this, but is there anything specific that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you feel is important to mention, or that you'd like to mention, especially perhaps for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book?
Well, one thing I would say is that, you know, sound is something that really, really matters. And I make constant reference to it in the book about how important it is and how people are overwhelmed by it. And yet when you read this book, you're not going to get to hear it. And that's one of the challenges of this. But I think it reflects the way that it formed, which is that so many people have heard of it and don't know what it is. And I thought, you know, well, I'm going to leave them still wondering, but that you would have, I can go in front of an audience of people, you know, at a university, and usually two or three people will know, you know, what I'm talking about. But several people will have heard that there's something like this happening. And so I thought, well, that's a lot, you know, the fact that you have something, that people have gossiped about, this like a great story that does the work of circulation, like lays the ground, and then the sound maybe never arrives even. And then there are people who are, of course, obsessive, and they would have, they would pick up this book and say, well, why don't you talk about the great sounds in it? So, that is a conflict with writing this kind of a book that I wanted to bring up. And I want to mention like my attempts to deal with it, which is I did make a website where I put up some of the films and our videos and sound recordings, just to, because I know that someone's going to want to Google it immediately, and you know, you can end up all sorts of places, which is great. You know, I don't want to control what people think of or what they hear, but I wanted to put some examples from the book that sort of illustrate the sounds and performances that I'm talking about. So it's www.japannoise.com, and there's a bunch of videos and sounds there.
Great, thank you so much. So, David, now that the book is out, and again, congratulations, as I'm sure is clear, not just for my enunciating it, but also from the nature of the conversation that we've just had, it's also an extraordinarily thoughtful and thought-provoking book, and that's true for even a non-specialist like myself who comes to it just with an interest in reading. An interesting book that seems somehow relevant to East Asian studies, and it turns out is relevant to so much more than that. But now that the book is out and the project is at least closed in this stage of it, what's next for you? Are there any projects that are currently inspiring you, and what can we look forward to in the future?
Thanks. Yeah. Well, one of the things that you mentioned was that this book is about noise with a capital N as a genre and in this circulation. And the thing that I had to leave out are so many of the things that inform our ideas about what noise is. You know, noise as something that disrupts society, and noise as something that interferes with understanding and meaning. And so I've been doing an edited volume with my colleague Matt Sakakini at Tulane, called Keywords in Sound, in which we isolate some of these concepts, because, you know, there's this emerging field, emerging for quite a while now, called sound studies. You might have a new book in sound studies one of these days. I don't know.
Yeah.
and you have a lot of people dealing with sound in ways that in which you see that these ideas are used in radically different ways. So claims that you can make, for instance, about noise that don't really line up with the way that they're used. So one of the arguments I make here is that, yeah, noise can be music. Of course it can be. And that although the very idea of it is being separate from context of silence or context, you know, of signal, in fact, you need noise to make meaning, or you need noise to, you know, as part of music, and that you need noise to create, you know, the communication, you know, relies to some degree on it. So I wrote the chapter on noise for that. So I'm trying to broaden out my thinking about noise there, and to sort of make reference to the ways in which noise is this extremely overproductive concept, and sort of tracing out some of the things that I didn't get to do in the book, where you could take it. It's a very short keyword, you know, it's like 3,000 words. So we're also doing things like, you know, of course we have silence, we have, you know, the body, echo, and many other terms like that. And other than that book, I'm also doing a new project in Japan that's around the noise in the streets, around the anti-nuclear protests post-Fukushima, post-311. So one of my colleagues from the book, which I talk about it a little bit in the book, Otome Yoshihide, is from Fukushima, and he started a festival there, Project Fukushima, that brings people back to the area for, you know, music performances. And then the other thing I experienced in going back was getting swept up into the large protests in 2012, and people surrounded the Diet building and demanding against the restart of the nuclear power plants. And it's a very it's hard to be working in Japan right now, or to be doing any kind of project that isn't touched by what's going on around nuclear power. And so I've just been thinking a lot about, again, like drawing out some of the techno-cultural themes here about how people can, you know, end up knowing about these things, and how they end up feeling what it's like to live in a society that's under that kind of threat when you don't have a sensory connection. So making noise in the streets, getting together, being together in a co-present situation of protest. And it reflects with what's happening around the world, with the Occupy movement, with Tahrir Square, with people being in a co-present space with one another and putting their bodies on the line as part of an attempt to create discourse with governments that aren't going to hear it in any other way.
Well, both of those sound absolutely fantastic. So best of luck. Thank you again for making time to talk with me. And it really was a pleasure. Congratulations on the book.
Thanks so much, Carla.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.